Rhea. You'll see a Gia like Mia. Never would they never be another like Gia.
Hello, welcome to another episode of MLB Talk. My name is Andrew. I am joined by Vitaly and Chase. Nadia is not here today, but that's all right. One of these days, we'll get all four of us in here, and it'll be something to behold. But for now, if you want to call us and complete the circle of four, you can call us at 310-794-9348. That's 310-794-9348. And, of course, you are listening on UCLAradio.com. So we open this week's show with some old news, but I think probably still the biggest story of the early spring training games slash most boring part of the year cycle. Josh Hamilton was not caught by a drug test, ladies and gentlemen. No one saw him doing drugs on the street or anything like that. No, he turned himself in to Major League Baseball for doing cocaine and drinking. Let's be real. So he has had a long checkered history, you know, did a lot of drugs as a minor leaguer, suspended from 2004 to 2006, and then reinstated. Became one of the best players in baseball for a time, hired an accountability partner to pretty much just keep him sober.
Yeah, he's been working out really well.
Yeah, that actually was successful for a time because I think, you know, with Ron Washington's history as the manager of the Rangers, they had some drug problems and they definitely took that pretty seriously. However, in 2014, Josh sort of downsized the role of his accountability partner and supposedly sort of just brought friends with him to road games. And then it wasn't really clear what he did at home when he's playing for the Angels. So it's, you know, didn't really seem like there was too much accountability, to use that word. So, you know, it's pretty interesting. And I wonder, should his case be treated differently as he is a repeated offender? Well, how do you guys feel about...
I think one thing that needs to be mentioned first is, although, yes, it's true that he did turn himself in, after his 2006 reinstatement, the agreement was that he has to take 3 urine tests a week. So even if he did turn himself in or didn't do it eventually, he would have been caught in like a day or two. He's required by the Angels to take 3 urine tests a day. And he says, well, he knows he's going to get caught, so he might as well say it in first place. So I guess that has to be mentioned, but... To be honest, I don't know. I feel like he's had so many relapses. I think it's been 2004. Like, he had those 2 years, and then 2008, 2011, and then 2012, and then 2015 recently. And, like, yes, obviously he feels sorry, and he doesn't try to, like, relapse. But, I mean, how many, opportunities are you going to get? It's great that the Rangers are helping him. I think, in fact, that when they were winning in the playoffs, rather than celebrating with champagne, they would celebrate with apple cider or something just for helping him out. So it's great that he has support from his clubs, and then the Angels are supporting him all the way. But, I mean, I don't know. I just don't understand how many times you're going to do it. Like, if you have an accountability buddy or however you want to call him, and you have all these rules, yet within 5 years you relapse 3 or 4 times, I mean... I don't know.
Could you imagine major league teams having a buddy system? Okay, make sure you're with your buddy. Don't lose sight of your buddy on the road, like at the airport.
I think this is going to be one of those things where Rob Manfred, this is going to be one of his first big decisions as commissioner, because this isn't so much as where a guy gets suspended for taking steroids or gets caught taking Adderall, where it was almost by choice. What he's going to have to do here, he's kind of teetering the fine line of, you know, Josh Hamilton is definitely a drug addict. His history has been well known. Now you're going to determine, you know, how much of the addiction side is his choice or how much of it is a sickness. And then I think from there, that's where he's going to have to, you know, start to go down before deciding on a punishment. And I think with Hamilton, and I remember when he was a free agent, you know, the New York media saying he wouldn't be a good fit because it's New York. And I think even though in terms of baseball ability, he was a great fit in Los Angeles at the time, this is probably along with New York and, you know, any other big markets like this where there's so much media, so much going on, probably one of the worst fits in terms of from an addiction standpoint that Hamilton could have signed with. And I think, you know, those first 2 years he had down years, who knows if that led him to him relapsing. And I think eventually just it could have been the Los Angeles lifestyle eventually caught up with him.
Do you think that he would have been more safe had he stayed with the Rangers? I remember, if I remember correctly, they did offer him something in this a similar ballpark to what the Angels did.
I just think with Texas also, it's one when you're comfortable anywhere, you know, once you have that comfort level, I think that'll definitely help. But I think for him, it's like what you said before. You know, Ron Washington, part of the reason he left the Rangers was because of a cocaine habit that was very similar to Hamilton's. And I think having, aside from an accountability partner, but a manager who can sympathize with you and understand what you're going through while working through your problems, I think that was a big thing to where you're moving kind of from, like, the quietness of the ballpark at Arlington to the limelight of L.A., where no one's really been through this situation before. For the most part, it's a pretty young team where he was kind of thrust into a leadership role as well. And I do think, truthfully, if he stayed in Texas, this might not be happening. But on the flip side, you know, that's one of the things with addiction and relapsing. You never know when it's going to happen. It's just so unpredictable.
I think it's really important that you pointed out that Manfred's really supposed to be involved in all of this, because the problem is if he does really take issue with this, you don't want to act too harshly, just because this might just do a lot of damage to the player himself. If he gets banned for maybe a year or half a year, that just might spiral him into depression and he might relapse again. So you also, there's a very fine line that you want to be walking when you're approaching the situation. And I don't think you can punish him too strictly, but then again, he can't get away with things. I guess, what does he have, like a 5-game suspension?
It's unclear at this time what his suspension is going to be. And, you know, in addition to that, because he's recovering from shoulder surgery, part of the suspension would go towards the games that he's on the DL. So, you know, if he has to miss, you know, 50 games and the suspension's 50 games, he can come back when he's healthy. But I think there's also a larger question here that needs to be asked, which is basically, I mean, it's something that normally we don't come across because not many players honestly have this problem. But there's a really interesting, it's pretty unclear what kind of role recreational or, like, illegal drugs have in Major League Baseball. You know, Major League players are supposed to be role models, and I'm totally fine with these sorts of things being against the rules. I think players, you know, if the league decides that that's what they want, that, you know, things that don't improve players' abilities and actually probably harm them, if they want that to be something that's not part of the game, that's fine with me. But if they don't want it to be part of the game, how then can you turn around and tell everyone, oh, hey, this player who's a part of our respected league did this drug? It's a strange conflict. It's a bit of a paradox. And I sort of wonder what your guys' take on it is, because there's a different way of handling this where you say, Josh Hamilton did something. We're not going to tell anyone what. Try to keep it very closed doors, suspend him and not say why, or even make up a different excuse. Because, and I know that sounds terrible, and in other leagues, teams have been criticized very harshly for this, the Baltimore Ravens in particular. But I think you have to think about who's being harmed. And there are little kids who've looked up to Josh Hamilton, and maybe now they have a worse outlook on life even. So I guess I want to hear what you guys have to say about that very tricky topic.
Yeah, the first thing I'll say is, you know, as much as I love baseball, and, you know, Derek Jeter for me is the biggest icon ever in my life, but baseball players and the baseball game as a whole, it's not really a game that, even if, no matter how far you go back, it's not a game where the best players necessarily have been role models. You go back to Babe Ruth, the guy who put baseball on the map. This guy was he was out partying every night before the game. He was a borderline drunk. He was a racist. You go 50s and 60s, these guys are all on amphetamines. You know, even to today and throughout baseball, you know, you could see every single baseball player just with a fat thing of chewing tobacco in, which, you know, once you get into, like, middle school, high school, you understand what's going on. And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, chewing tobacco amongst high school baseball players is so prevalent. So I think to say baseball players are role models, I don't think they ever have been, per se. I think the thing with Hamilton is, it's like I said before, you really just have to realize, you know, this is a guy who has a problem, and I think Manfred has to decide, are we going to make an example of this guy? Is he going to be the guy where we make a new policy around it? Or are we just going to kind of, you know, teeter along like we've been for years and just handle drug problems on a per-case basis?
Vitaly, any thoughts on sort of the role of drugs?
I guess... I think Chase said it correctly. It's a per-case basis. You know, the NFL has been having a lot of drug problems recently, but they're mostly been having issues with marijuana. But the thing is, the players would say that it helps with concussions and concussion symptoms. So, but yet, it's still, I think it's a Scheduled 1 classified drug by the federal government, just as cocaine or heroin or anything like that. So it makes it really tricky to find out what and how exactly you're going to judge and what exactly is the problem that the player is doing. Because cocaine's a serious issue, and if he can't get away with it, and if it seems, I think I read about it, and every time he happens to take cocaine, it's first was triggered by drinking alcohol. So I guess you have to find out what the root of his problem is. And like I said, Chase said this perfectly, it's a per-case basis. You know, it's hard to tell. It's not a very widespread issue in the MLB, so you can't really take a whole policy, because once you do impose a policy, you'd say it's for the whole league, but mainly it's aimed towards just one player. I don't know if that's fair.
I want to jump back to something that Chase said that I think is really interesting. You know, I don't see Major League Baseball players as role models either. You know, they're athletes first and foremost. They don't... Some of them want the spotlight, like Alex Rodriguez. And a lot of them, though, come from very humble origins and aren't really into that. And they just want to play the game. And I'm totally on board with that. But I think the country has a very different perspective of our athletes because they're in the spotlight, that there's supposed to be more asked of them. And, you know, I guess I wonder if that is something that can even be changed, or if we just have to accept that our athletes are going to make mistakes and it's going to look bad for the kids, but we as average citizens have to just cope with that.
Yeah, and just going back to like the per case basis and now to applying it to role models, I have my dad texting me listening. An example of this, like in terms of a poster boy of a guy doing drugs who was a star player in the past, was Daryl Strawberry. And when he eventually got suspended for cocaine, it was a 60-day suspension. And I think what's the key with Hamilton here is, no matter what happens, how much, you know, what the punishment is, if his contract gets voided by the Angels in some degree, which is a whole nother issue, it's really all about PR damage. And I think, you know, if Hamilton apologizes, he, you know, can go a certain amount of time where he could prove he's clean. I think the media and the public ultimately will forgive him. And I think that's, you know, even if you look at Daryl Strawberry now, he's a children's author. He's done so much good for the community that, you know, people kind of look past the fact that, you know, him and Dwight Gooden were skipping the World Series parade because they were doing coke, whereas now it's like, oh, well, he's this charitable guy and a great redemption story. So hopefully Hamilton can become that, but I just think he's definitely got a long road back to even playing the game again, let alone being what he was in Texas.
What children's book did Daryl Strawberry write? That's what I want to know.
I actually own the book because we went to a book signing with him. I don't know the title offhand, but I can look it up and find it.
Is it a play off his name?
I don't think so. It was something about the Yankees and children, I want to say. But he was a very nice guy. He was a larger-than-life figure, but...
I feel like it should be something like Strawberries in the Outfield.
Something tells me it wasn't.
No. That's what I would go for.
It was called... Nope, that's not it. That's his biography. You guys keep going. Transition on to the next topic, and I'll keep looking.
So, sort of... hidden under everything else that's going on, a little more minor. The Dodgers have a very interesting situation with Alex Guerrero, a player who they thought was going to be their, you know, shortstop of the immediate future a while ago. Then his ear got bitten off, and also he's not that good. So basically, there's no slot for him on the team. You know, they're already crowded in the outfield, and their infield, including backups, is pretty set. However, Alex Guerrero has a very interesting contract. He can actually refuse a minor league assignment, forcing the Dodgers to either put him on the 25-man, trade him, or release him. If they release him, they owe him $14 million over the next 3 years. So I think it's four this year, and then five the year after that, and five the year after that. And if they trade him, the team that receives him, receives Guerrero on the trade, only has 1 year of control before he becomes a free agent instead of three. In other words, his contract has a trade clause. And that makes him highly invaluable to other teams, because if he you know, breaks out and turns out to be a valuable player, he's going to get a huge pay raise. And if he sucks, then you wasted money and prospects to get a player who's worthless. So, you know, do you feel like, I sort of wonder, what can the Dodgers do? You know, is a guy like Justin Turner maybe better as a trade piece to sort of help move along Ethier, or is Guerrero the one who needs a way out?
I think the Dodgers are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place here, because this just kind of shows, and we even talk about it with Moncada signing, even though he's a stud prospect, there's just so much unpredictability with these Cuban guys, just because you've never seen them face American competition. That, you know, this guy wasn't as heralded, but they signed him to, what was it, 4-for-32 overall?
Yeah, something like that.
And it was almost like they signed them on a hunch just because they had the money to do so, and it just shows with these Cuban guys, these signings can definitely come back and bite you in the ass. In my opinion, I'm looking at their infield depth. It's Justin Turner and Darwin Barney in front of them. I know Turner had a good year last year, but I remember watching him play with the Mets. He was never too inspiring, and if anything, he is coming off a good year this past season where he hit over 300. You know, why not trade him? A team might want to take him as a utility guy. You know, even Darwin Barney is a great fielder, but I don't know if he's ever hit above, I'm going to say, around 240 in his career. So I think at this point, if you're stuck with them, you know, don't eat the dead money, even though they're spending money left and right. Give the kid a shot and see what he can do, and, you know, hopefully he just provides some value.
The thing is, where would you put him? You mean you have Jimmy Rollins at short, and you have Howie Kendrick at second. Do you put him at third instead of Juan Uribe?
I think you just have him as, like, your backup infielder or utility guy, just, you know, in case anyone needs a spell.
Yeah, I think Turner is probably going to be, like, the most expendable, because obviously you'd want to say Barney, but no team is really going to take him. But he does have value because he is a gold glove caliber second baseman. You know, I think you really need defense in a pinch. That's who you're going to go to. So I think because they really, really need to find a way to move Ethier anyways, that if you can package it with Turner, maybe find an enticing place. Yeah, I think actually L.A. is not a terrible fit. Considering, you know, they do have, well, Matt Joyce is already a left-hander, but they need some outfield help, and they definitely need second base help because Josh Rutledge is looking like the starter over there.
I mean, to me, it looks like Alex Guerrero just needs to play well enough to be able to get traded, because he's a 4-year, $30 million. That's a pretty large contract for someone who hasn't really been playing, and to prove that to other teams is going to be pretty difficult. So I can't see him starting with this infield. Maybe he plays in the outfield, but I don't know.
Yeah, my thing with Turner is I'm just looking at his actual numbers now. Turner had 288 at-bats last year, which, you know, for a utility guy, is a relatively high amount, but that's like a pretty good sample size across the board. Justin Turner last year in those 288 at-bats hit 340 with a 404 on base and an almost 900 OPS. I can guarantee you
that's not going to happen.
Justin Turner will never have those numbers again. So at this point, when he's coming off, you know, there's always that one team who's willing to bite on a guy who has that one outlier year. Why not see if anyone will take a shot at Turner? And I definitely agree with what you said about the Angels, just because their infield isn't great. Is David Freese still their third baseman?
Yes.
He's super injured.
Isn't that hard to believe?
He's super injury prone as well. When he inevitably gets hurt, Turner can slip into third. And yeah, I think he would definitely be a good trade target for the Angels.
The thing is, even with, you know, even though Turner had an out of this world season last year, you factor in regression, I mean, he could still probably hit around 300. So it's pretty valuable. I mean, average is definitely not something that you can put too much stock into these days, but, you know, for 300 something at bats, it's probably more meaningful. So definitely an intriguing piece. And the other thing I want to do before we take a break is go over some injuries, because there's some funny stuff in here, and then maybe some other things that are more important. So first off, Melvin Upton, who's, you know, first week as not Boss Man Jr., already has foot inflammation, is going to be out for 5 to 6 weeks. This leaves the Braves with pretty much nobody. What do you what do you guys think of sort of the approach that the Braves have taken to this past this season? And then also, you know, has Upton really just completely derailed their plan?
Melvin Upton. I think at this point he's kind of going to go down as, you know, their one big regret in terms of free agency. This was a team, the Braves, who throughout the Frank Wren era always, you know, they built that team on trades, free agents, and the draft. And, you know, this was the first time they gave him the highest contract ever given to a Braver, which when you think of the fact that Greg Maddux, John Smoltz, Tom Glavin, Chipper Jones, four first ballot Hall of Famers all played for the team is insane. But I think the approach they're taking is interesting because they're blowing it up, but they're not blowing it up all the way, if that makes sense. You know, they signed Markakis in free agency, Johnny Gomes, who's not terrible. They still have Freeman, traded for Shelby Miller because they thought Hayward was going to walk. I think it'll be interesting, but I think John Hart, who just took over the team, is going to have to decide soon, you know, is this the group we want going forward, or are we really going to blow this up? And I think at that point what you do is you put Craig Kimbrel on the block, because if you really want to replenish your farm system, I mean, this guy has been as sure of a thing in baseball over the past 3-4 years as anybody.
Yeah, I think they need to completely blow it up. You know, we've seen this, the Astros, you know, pretty much lost 5 years of valuable rebuilding time by just sort of putting themselves in the middle and saying, yeah, Kaz Matsui, you can have 600 bats a year, no problem. So they definitely need to sort that out. I think it's honestly hard to blame the front office for the B.J. Upton deal. Just going to call it B.J. Upton deal because that's his name when he signed it. It didn't really seem like this was the player he was going to turn into. I think, you know, his bat speed is just kind of eh, and his eye, which was valuable, just sort of evaporated, for lack of a better term. And I think, I totally agree with you. Kimbrel is a guy who is dominant, but because of his role, is never going to provide an abundance of value. Whereas, you know, you trade him for a couple of good prospects, you know, talking lots and lots of team control and overall years. I think that's the way to go. And then also see what Freddie Freeman can get you. Yeah, he's the team's best hitter and the only, like, young, valuable person on the infield at this point.
Oh, well,
you might as well just see what you can get. I'm not saying move him.
Yeah, older than Simmons is pretty solid, but
He needs to be able to show that he can actually hit.
So. Oh, great. I think the problem is also with them blowing it up is, you know, in the past year or two, they gave Freeman that big 5 to 7 year extension for over a hundo. They gave Simmons an extension. They gave Turhanahan an extension. You know, at the time, it made sense, you know, locking up these young guys for relatively cost-effective contracts. It's just, you know, they couldn't have predicted that they would be trading Justin Upton away. Like, I know when they traded him for Prado, this was a guy who was going to be there for the long haul. Now, you know, all of a sudden, one or two things go wrong, and it's going to be a completely new team.
Well, the thing about some of those deals that you mentioned, the Freeman extension, the Simmons extension, I don't remember what Tehran got, but those are fairly team-friendly deals. You go around to the league where teams need to fill those positions, they would probably do that trade. I mean, you look at the Simmons one especially. If, you know, he hit 17 home runs the year before last, there's definitely power there. Obviously, the glove provides a tremendous amount of value. If he can learn to actually hit for, like, consistent contact, you're talking about a very, very, very cost-effective deal. And I think Freeman's going to be a great hitter for a long time, so same goes for him. I think they definitely need to be flexible because you don't. The last thing you want to do is get stuck in no man's land. And so we move on to the other injuries. I want to get to the funniest one. Michael Saunders, who the Blue Jays pretty much stole from the Mariners for, I don't know, I guess the Mariners just didn't have space for him, trips on a sprinkler and tears his meniscus. Now everyone, he was originally reported to be out till around the All-Star break. Looked like it's only going to be 6 weeks, but that's just kind of brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, I think one, you know, it says 5 to 6 weeks, but what people don't realize with the torn meniscus, it's just something that kind of lingers with you. I've seen it. I have a close friend from home, Sam Beck, who blew up both his knees and eventually had to get major surgery that started with meniscus. You see it now with Derrick Rose, who's on his third knee surgery, which started with an ACL and meniscus. And, you know, I think it'll definitely be a tough recovery for a guy who really, in getting traded to Toronto, a lot of people had him as like a sleeper for a breakout year. And I think it's sad to see that. But also, I'm looking at their outfield depth. I mean, besides Jose Bautista, they have this Dalton Pompey. Have you ever heard of him?
Nope. Well, I mean, I've heard of him in reference to, oh, man, the Blue Jays outfield is so shallow that they've got to use the, like, Kevin Pillar.
Yeah, and Kevin.
His last name is freaking Pillar, but he pronounces it Pillar.
And Kevin Pillar, those, and them and Saunders, that's their only four outfielders. So, you know, with him out, they need to figure out something. I don't know if there's anyone left on the market. I mean, maybe we were talking about it before. They've spent a lot. Maybe they take on Ethier at this point, but.
Yeah, they're actually a great fit for Ethier now that I think about it. You know, one of the interesting things about them is that I think they really had Colby Rasmus pegged as a breakout player, and it's just very apparent he is a clubhouse negative.
Oh, yeah.
So much so that the only team that really seemed to have interest is Astros, because, you know, when he was on the Cardinals, this is a guy who people were saying, hey, you know, if everything goes right, he could be 30-30. And then there was all these issues with his dad and Tony La Russa, and now all of a sudden he's gone. So I think that was a big issue for the Blue Jays. Regardless of that, I think they look pretty good, especially considering Jonathan Papelbon saying that he would accept the trade to the Blue Jays. I think that was pretty interesting, but we might touch on that later. Another interesting injury that I really want to hear more about, Ronald Belisario, who formerly pitched for the Dodgers, then closer for the White Sox for a spell, injured himself getting out of a pool. How does that work? I think it was he was pressing himself over the ledge as opposed to using like the little stairs, and he just is just not that athletic.
And he fractured his shoulder doing so.
Hey, weirder things have happened.
Yeah, you could trip over a sprinkler. I mean,
yeah, or you could, like, pull a Jeremy Affeldt and, like, lift a bag and be out for, like, a couple weeks, or cut your finger making hamburgers. I mean, but still, this one's pretty bad, and I think, you know, a lot of people are going to underestimate the Rays this year. I certainly have a hard time seeing how they're going to be good like they used to be, especially without Joe Maddon. But, you know, this might actually be something that's somewhat significant for them.
Yeah, listen, I'm not going to give this guy too much grief, because as someone who broke his foot slipping getting out of a bathtub, I understand. It's a little slippery sometimes around water. Anything could happen. But, yeah, I mean, looking at this Rays pen that he was going to be a big part of, you know, right now their closer is Grant Balfour, who is coming off a year where it was very on and off with the A's and Rays. He had his ups, he had his downs. He had that great year with the A's in 2013. So I think he's a guy who's on improvement. Other than him, you know, the only guy of note really is Jake McGee, who even he has been on and off. You know, I think with Tampa, it's going to be the same thing that it's been for years. They're going to be very scrappy, and they're going to live and die with their rotation, which, truthfully, if Alex Cobb just furthers, you know, to make the jump between him, Chris Archer, Drew Smyly, Matt Moore when he's back, and Jake Odorizzi, like, this could be, you know, one of the surprise rotations
in
baseball.
When you say that out loud, that group sounds amazing. A lot of people aren't big on Odorizzi because of his trouble with walks, home runs, but he's cut down the walks. His strikeout rate is excellent. I'm a big fan of his late round sleeper pick for me in fantasy for sure. And the rest of those guys are pretty great. I think they definitely, when you say it like that, it's so hard to believe how well they recovered from losing David Price. I mean, that rotation is as deep as any, honestly. Just in terms of, I mean, they don't have a true ace yet, but they really have top to bottom. Do you guys think that Kevin Cash can retain some of the analytics that made Joe Maddon such a great manager? Because I really think that's honestly important, that if they revert to a more old-school style of managing, I think they will suffer on a somewhat significant scale.
It's funny. When I heard they hired Kevin Cash, the first thing I did was call my dad and say, is this the same Kevin Cash who, you know, was our backup catcher for, like, months at a time with the Yankees? I think the difference will be is I think there will still be some analytics. I think you see with catchers who become managers, I think just because of the position of catching and everything that goes into it, I think they definitely maintain the analytical side. And I also think, you know, part of the reason that made Joe Maddon so successful was because he brought all this energy, all this excitement to the team. And I think because Kevin Cash is around 37 years old, it'll be good to have a nice, you know, youthful injection into this team. You know, who I think, like what we said before, you know, with this rotation and a bounce back year from Evan Longoria, maybe this is a team who can definitely compete in what's probably been the weakest AL East in, I would say, at least the past 10 years.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, they're always a little light on heading, but they'll figure it out. And it's that time where we take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about injuries and whatnot, get into some more topics, and do our WWE Match of the Week. You are listening to UCLA Radio. This is MLB Talk. Hello, welcome back to MLB Talk. You are listening to us on UCLARadio.com. And of course, if you want to listen to us at some other time or show us to your friends, which I know a lot of you have been doing, you can listen to our podcast at UCLAMLBTalk.podomatic.com. That's UCLAMLBTalk.podomatic.com. And I want to thank everyone who's been supporting us through the podcast lately. Been getting a ton of listens, and it really means the world to me. I appreciate it a lot. And to both of you for your, you know, communicating that it is available. So it's really great, and I'm excited to keep building this fan base, and hopefully we can have some more interaction. So call us. Not going to say the number again, but call us. Okay, so it's time for Tweet of the Week, I believe. And we're going to start with you, Chase, because we had the same Tweet of the Week to begin with.
All right. I'm going to change my tweet up just because.
What?
No, I just texted you about this.
Oh.
That you could do the tweet. That and about the 2005 White Sox. I'll touch on that later.
Okay.
My tweet is from Kevin Millar, former baseball player who now hosts the show Intentional Talk. And his tweet is, taking physical this AM and nothing more special than the words of Doc saying, drop your pants, try and relax, and turn around and bend over. A very interesting tweet from, to me, the most personal guy in all of baseball.
Yeah, that, you know, I sort of just don't like his play, but he's a funny guy. He seems really nice, so good tweet, good choice. Okay, so I'll take that one, and I'm going to double up because I had a replacement one all lined up, so I'm totally going to do it. So, Juan Pierre, okay, I apologize for the static that is happening now, but anyhow, Juan Pierre retired last week, and he sent out a memorable tweet for his retirement. I do have one regret. Oh, and I forgot to, his Twitter handle is at JP Beast Mode, which I feel like Marshawn Lynch should have a problem with, but he doesn't for some reason. Anyways, I do have one regret. I finished with 18 home runs, really wanted to get to 20. So if any team wants to sign me for 3 years, that should be enough time. I just, a perfect combination of humor and classiness, really digging it. And then Vitaly, if you want to do yours, I'll come back to my second one.
Sure. Mine comes from a reporter from New Jersey. His name's Brandon Cootie. I'm not really sure.
Is that Kid Cudi or?
K-U-T-I.
Okay.
K-U-T-Y.
I was close.
Cootie. I'm not sure. Anyways, it goes, Chris Young just struck out against the pitching machine.
Yes.
Hashtag Yankees.
I can't believe this. Wasn't I saying I was not sure about Chris Young? I'm telling you, I'm not confident in his abilities anymore. Maybe it was the other way around. Maybe I'm totally being a hypocrite right now.
No, I think you were putting me in my place about Chris Young.
Can you believe that? I don't even think we would strike out against a pitching machine.
I definitely might.
The sad thing is,
shorten up your swing, man. Choke up.
I can believe it. That's the problem.
It's just, you know, thank God, in this day and age of Vine, I'm amazed it wasn't captured on Vine, but also very glad for Chris Young, because I don't think he deserves that. Okay, and my second tweet of the week is sort of a small conversation between the Reno Aces and their parent team, the Arizona Diamondbacks. So, at Aces, dear D-backs, any chance we can get one of those llamas as a pinch runner this year? And then in response, the official Arizona Diamondbacks Twitter, like they need any more seasoning in the minors. They're major league ready. So, for those of you who are not aware, last week there were two llamas in Sun City, Arizona that were set loose and hilariously chased around by police, other people, and I think their owner probably for like 30 minutes. ABC got the whole thing on a chopper. This complete riot. Pretty much any time a police car or people tried to cut them off, the llamas would just turn around and pretty much they just ran in like a half-mile circle for a long time. And then it didn't show how the black llama was captured. He sort of just got encircled. But the white llama, who's faster and just overall better prospect, was actually lassoed in, which is just hilarious. You'd never, like, who would think of lassoing a llama? Like, they didn't even have trank darts or anything, but they successfully lassoed the llama. And that was
neck, I guess it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I guess, but I just feel like it's a small target.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know much about lassoing. Anyways, I love llamas. After this whole thing, I just, honestly, made my week last week. Okay, so other baseball related things, non-Llama related. So big news story out of Marlins camp: Giancarlo Stanton hit by a pitch. Oh no! And there's this vine of it, and he pretty much just turning his hip. So obviously, this was made into a real big deal because spring training's only starting, and he's already gotten hit. So, do you guys think that this is going to be something to keep track of over the rest of the year, or is it just something that is a big deal because it's fresh in people's mind, and once games start, it's just going to sort of fade away?
You know, I think it could be a definite problem, to be honest, and I think part of the reason that that big contract has been so scrutinized to some degree is, you know, as great of a season as Stanton had last year, he's got all the potential in the world. It's one thing to, like, get hit in the knee during a spring training thing. It's another thing when you're getting in there against a 95-mile-per-hour fastball again because, and it's like we've talked about, this guy, it's one thing to get hit in the ankle and the shoulder and break a bone. This guy got hit in the face and was knocked cold. That's, you know, I could say one thing. Granted, I'm not Giancarlo Stanton. I'd be terrified to ever get in a batter's box again. So I think it'll be interesting what happens with him. And one thing, you know, I see you put on the notes. If I'm most pitchers, I'm pitching him inside every single
time. Yeah, I thought
time.
You would say that.
And honestly, you know, I have pitched before in the past. You work towards people's weaknesses. Pitching is so much of it is mental and trying to psych out the batter. You pitch him inside. I think you do that until he adjusts. If he shows he's going to adjust and, you know, A, show he's not afraid, but B, if you just pitch him inside, turn into a Miguel Cabrera-type hitter and just smack doubles the other way, then I think, you know, you pitch him normal. But until he proves otherwise, yeah, take advantage over the fact that, you know, he might still be a little haunted by this. Why not?
Well, here's the thing that's interesting about the pitching inside strategy is Giancarlo's slugging is actually highest on pitches on inside on the inner third of the plate. However, you go beyond that to the area where it's a ball and even closer to his body, it actually his results are actually pretty poor. But, you know, he is like somewhat like Miguel Cabrera in the sense that they can turn very quickly on a ball. And I still think pitchers are definitely going to attack him there more often until he can prove that it's not an issue. But I think after that, there's actually going to be, I feel like, a point where either Giancarlo could get upset or maybe there'll be ejections. I think some guys will definitely get too close to it. I definitely see him having a career best in hit by pitches this year, although it may not be a positive thing.
Are they going to allow him to wear the new mask in-game?
I don't think they have a problem with it. One of the things I always remember is actually from hockey. San Jose Sharks player Rob Blake, I mean, formerly played for the Kings and all that, he broke his jaw on a puck and then came back like a day or two later with this crazy metal mask all around, pretty much up around his upper lip. And no one had any problem with that because, you know, it doesn't affect the game really at all. And it just keeps the player safe. I'm okay with it. I think Stanton should probably be required to wear it. You'd hate to lose a talent like that to another freak accident like this. And besides, the thing looks freaking awesome. It's got a really cool shape. It's not, you know, you expect it to be more like a softball mask, but it's not. It's sort of just curved to the jaw, and then it's got like a G that forms this like circle around his cheek. It's more rectangular than I'm describing it though. It's overall pretty wide. But I'm a big fan of it. I'm totally okay with it. You know, ever since David Wright got his concussion against Matt Cain, he's been wearing that super helmet thing that makes him look like a dork, but keeps him safe, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I don't think that it's going to make that much of a difference in future games. You know, pitchers aren't going to stop throwing, like Trey said, they're not going to stop throwing inside until he adjusts to that. And eventually it's going to happen. Like this past incident, he got hit in the hip, which is a really common place to get hit, especially if it's an inside pitch. So I can't imagine that much being changed. I don't think that he should get any special rules. Like, I understand that it was a freak accident, but they've taken necessary precautions to prevent that from happening again. So I don't think it's going to change much.
It'll be interesting to see if Mike Fiers has another matchup against Stanton, what will happen. I feel like it would just sort of be like a pitch around. Not an intentional walk, but just a bunch of pitches low in the zone, nowhere near him. I think that's what you can expect. And again, I want to apologize for the static. It might just be on our end, so I could just be sounding like a fool right now, but we'll work on it later with technical department. So another thing that happened last week, Buster Posey named or not named. I wish he could be more official. Voted by the fans, face of MLB, narrowly beating out David Wright, I think. Oh. And, you know, Buster defeated Mike Trout in like the third round or something. So there's some legitimacy to this claim, I think. I sort of want your guys' take on it. I think it's especially apt that you decide to wear a World Series, a 2012 World Series shirt today, Chase. Do you guys feel like Buster Posey can replace Derek Jeter as the icon?
I think what made Jeter so special is because he came up and did so much right away at shortstop, which is kind of, you know, throughout baseball history been known as the leadership position, you know, the toughest position out there. So I think Jeter's he's really a once-in-a-generation guy, but there are definitely a lot of parallels between him and Posey, and that Posey came up right away, run Rookie of the Year, won an MVP, which Jeter never won, won three rings in his first 5 years.
Batting champ. Recovered from one of the most gruesome injuries in recent baseball history.
You know, everything you just said, absolutely. I think all that definitely makes him a viable candidate. I'm looking at the full face of the MLB bracket right now. I think if not Posey, definitely Trout, just because this is a guy who, you know, anytime you're compared to like a Mickey Mantle type player, you know you're doing something right. I think Andrew McCutchen, just because he plays the game right, he brought the city of Pittsburgh back. And then, like we talked about a few weeks ago, how he's so involved in the African American community, and hopefully bringing them more into the game of baseball, I think is huge. I think Stanton could be the face of baseball. And, you know, I just think it's got to be one of those guys who, you know, he puts up the numbers, he's a likable guy, but ultimately the face of baseball, and I think what Posey has done, the guy's just, he's got to be a winner. That's what it comes down to in my book.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, but it's definitely true. I think that's why McCutchen, I think, is more distant. You don't see him, yes, he as a you know, I mean, yes, he's like above the average person, but I think the face of MLB needs to sort of even transcend the sport a little bit, so I think McCutchen falls short there. You know, the other guy to include in this conversation is Clayton Kershaw, naturally. I mean, a great Samaritan and, you know, also, I mean, hasn't won a World Series yet, but has all kinds of accolades. And, you know, that being said, you've got three players on the West Coast who are sort of in the running for this and seemingly lacking a player like that on the East Coast. Is it possible for the face of Major League Baseball to be a player on the West Coast? Or is that the sign that the sport is in decline?
Well, I don't think it's that big of a deal. I guess he plays on a West Coast team, but yeah, he does come from the East Coast. I think born in Georgia, played in Florida. So I guess he does have his Eastern roots. But what surprised me the most is I'm looking at the famous face of MLB bracket, and Sean Doolittle beat out Felix Hernandez. There's some really interesting kind of
yeah, I mean, a lot of it is like the Bay Area votes very strong in these sorts of competitions. So, you know, I mean, Eric Sogard, like, made it to the finals last year. Eric Sogard, I mean, most people don't even know who that is.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's definitely, like, a little bit, there's definitely some questions in that regard. But I think this year it definitely came out a little more even. And, you know, obviously you don't really see David Wright as the face of MLB. But I think that almost testifies to my point that, you know, West Coast has the advantage of being able to see the East Coast games early. East Coast people can't see all the West Coast games, and that's sort of why I brought up that question. I think that it's maybe a sign that the sport needs to. I don't know. It's a problem that's going to always occur, and I think no, Posey will not receive the same kind of attention that Jeter gets, and eventually someone on the East Coast will sort of take that mantle, I think.
I mean, to be honest, though, if you do look at the MLB today and you look at players who have collected their accolades, Buster Posey definitely has to be at the top of that list. I mean, we already mentioned everything. You know, mainly the three championships in 5 years. I think he's caught two no-hitters, one perfect game. He almost had another perfect game with Petit that was ruined on the 3-2 count with two outs in the ninth inning. That almost made me cry. But he's been an outstanding catcher. He's a nice guy. He has that southern hospitality that if you ever see him talk, he's very nice, very polite, very humble, always cool, calm, and collected. Every time he had the interview in the playoffs, he's like, yes, our team played well, never gave him all the credit, even though he was outstanding, especially in the 2012 and 2010 World Series. But I think it's rightfully owned right now. I'm just really excited that it's going on because I think Mike Trout is going to take over this very, very soon. The amount of potential that kid has is unbelievable, and he's becoming very popular very quickly in the MLB. So,
yeah, and I think when it comes down to it, to me, you know, West Coast, East Coast, Central America, it doesn't really matter as long as you're playing in a big market, for say. And I think part of the reason, you know, Derek Jeter was so big. He played in the New York market. Even David Wright now. I mean, David Wright, he's the captain of the Mets, and he's definitely a house name. It's just, when was the last time David Wright stayed healthy and had, like, a David Wright-esque year? And that's why I think, you know, St. Louis Cardinals, they're, you know, in the middle of Central America. But Albert Pujols was, you know, probably from 2004 or, like, once Bonds started getting a lot of crap to, like, 2009 when he won his last World Series. No one was going to argue that Albert Pujols wasn't the face of baseball, if not Derek Jeter. So I think that it doesn't necessarily matter where the player plays. I think as long as, one, they win, two, they can back it up with their stats, and three, you know, definitely a rich baseball team with a good fan base and tradition helps a lot.
Okay. And with the last remaining 8 or so minutes on the show, Chase, I understand you want to discuss a little bit of the 2005 White Sox.
All right, so bear with me. I'm wearing a San Francisco Giants World Series champs shirt, and we were outside talking before the show just about, like, random World Series teams that have won championships, and I was talking about and I brought up how the 2005 White Sox won the World Series, and we all kind of looked at each other like, who are the 2005 White Sox? Like, even, like, the random teams that have come and gone, you can always name, like, one player or a couple players. So without further ado, some of the highlights of the 2005 White Sox. So behind the dish, you had the grit and scumbagness of none other than A.J. Pierzynski. Paul Konerko, Mr. White Sox at first, having, you know, your typical 40-homer, 100-ribby, under-the-radar Paul Konerko year. Tadahito Iguchi at second base. He's a guy.
Sorry?
Tadahito Iguchi. He was like in between. He was like post-Matt Suey's, but he had a couple decent years. He ended up with Tampa after as a second baseman.
That guy.
Exactly.
I remember that guy now.
the California area's favorite, slightly out of shape Spanish baseball player, but the guy wins, Juan Uribe. Joe Creedy at third base. I want to say he got traded for, like, somewhat significant.
I have no idea who that is. Also, quick note on Juan Uribe. He's not – I wouldn't say he's out of shape exactly as much as his body is built backwards.
That's a good way of putting it.
Anyways, continue.
and then, all right, in the outfields you have Jermaine Dye, who – I mean, Jermaine Dye is probably one of the more, like, under-radar, not quite stud, but very good outfielders of the past 10 years. Aaron Rowan, who was great until he ran into a wall in Philly, and that was that. And
somehow won a championship again in 2010, though.
And Scott Podsednik.
Yes.
Like the quintessential, I'm going to hit like 290 with no power but steal a bunch of bases and start on your
team.
The
white Juan Pierre.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Thomas was still sticking around on this team. Jeff Blum is like a relatively recognizable name. But this team had four starters go 200 innings, which nowadays, you definitely don't see too much. The rotation was, you know, old reliable Mark Burley. The guy's pitched 200 innings since I've been alive. Freddie Garcia and the splitter. John Garland, who, you know, for a 2 or 3 year stretch, this guy won like 18 games every year and then just fell off the face of the earth.
Well, I think that has to do more with the state of baseball than his level of play, which I think was always consistently average, below average to slightly above average.
So you got him. You have two former Cuban Yankees, one who worked out well, one who didn't work out so well with the Yankees. Jose Contreras probably had his best year in the bigs that year. He won 15 games, had a 3.6 ERA, and then the rotation was rounded out by a 39-year-old Orlando Hernandez, but there's always been doubts about El Duque's age, so he could have been 45 for all we know.
Wow, that's...
But again, like when we say, it's like what we were just talking about with the Rays, though. Like when you look at that rotation now, and like you say to yourself, you're like, wow, like no one outstanding, but like that's just deep. A very solid deep rotation.
Definitely. Hmm. Calling card for the 2015 Rays, perhaps. It's been 10 years.
We'll see.
Anyways, it's in our last couple minutes here. It is time for the WWE match of the week. This week we have a stretcher match featuring two Colorado Rockies, Troy Tulowitzki and Carlos Gonzalez. The object of the match is to place the opponent on the stretcher, lock them in an ambulance, and send them away to DL to the DL for the rest of the season. Who do you guys got?
I think it's going to be whoever hurts themselves first, to be honest. I don't even think they're going to be fighting each other at this point. But I don't know. Tulo gets hurt too much. I'm going to have to go with Tulo. The thing is, Carlos Gonzalez might get hurt putting him inside the ambulance. So they might both just end up inside of it. But
I feel like Cargo is going to be a big disadvantage with his sort of knee issues. At the same time, Troy Tulowitzki is pretty stiff with the hip. And I think this will be decided by aerial attacks or just using the ropes, you know?
One thing I'll point out before I might give my prediction on those White Sox, managed by the impeccably crazy, would fit right in the WWE, Ozzie Guillen.
Maybe we'll be featured next time. Who knows? Managerial edition.
But with this match, I'm going no contest. There is no winner. Colorado Rockies fans are just the losers in this one.
Classic. Yeah, I think they'll probably have to have two ambulances there for this this match, just in case.
It also might be one of the shortest matches in WWE history.
Yeah, you want to know? I feel like Troy Tulowitzki has some height here, and I think he'd take Cargo down. Just sort of get something on that knee, and he'll be busted. So I'm going to take Tulo, and I think afterwards he'd probably feel a little bit sore, and then maybe his like shoulder is torn up, and he'll have to use the other ambulance. So yeah, no matter what, Colorado Rockies fans, sorry, it's tough out there.
I mean, then again, Tulo might come out hot, you know, as he usually does, and then somehow in the middle of the fight, break something, and then he goes the rest of the fight. You know,
Cargo's down for the count, and then Tulo just falls over. That's what I'm going for. We will announce the official results next week, and thank you for listening to this edition of WWE Match of the Week. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you for listening. We will be here next week. Same time, same channel. This is UCLA Radio, and thank you for swinging by.
Back by the beach. Still gonna bring the heat.